From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the search for Planet X. But here's what's happening. As many as 75 people working at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control may have been exposed to live anthrax bacteria. They are receiving treatment, the health agency said. Researchers in a high-level biosecurity laboratory failed to properly set up procedures and did not inactivate the bacteria. The CDC said the exposure occurred in Atlanta at the weekend. No one has yet shown any symptoms yet. Well, this sounds a little like Vietnam all over again, even though we've already been there in Iraq. But President Barack Obama says the U.S. will send 300 military advisors to Iraq to help fight Islamic-led insurgents. The president said the U.S. was prepared for targeted and precise military action if and when the situation on the ground requires it, but added that the U.S. troops would not fight in Iraq. Howard Bloom, the one I call the human computer, with us. Howard, my take is the world is in turmoil. How about you?
There's a bigger zone of conflict than we have seen in at least 20 years. It is 13,500 miles wide. It goes from Nigeria, where Boko Haram has attacked a group of people innocently trying to watch the World Cup soccer matches in the last 48 hours, on through to Kenya, which is on the very opposite side of Africa, where Al-Shabaab has attacked two nights in a row and killed as many villagers as it could get its hands on. 48 in one case, 12 in another case, straight across all the way to the South China Sea, 10,000 miles away. In the South China Sea, the Chinese have towed their biggest oil rig, a $1 billion oil rig, into waters claimed by Vietnam, and have basically thumbed their nose at the Vietnamese. They are about to tow a second one, their second biggest oil rig, into the Spratly Islands, which are claimed by Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, just about every country in the South China Sea. They're making a point. We own this territory. Meanwhile, a 1,400-year war, the war between militant Islam and the rest of the world, a war that's been going on since 628 AD, when Muhammad basically announced his plans for world conquest by sending what he called his letters to the emperors, six letters to the six biggest emperors of his day. That war is raging, and it's raging right now in particular in Iraq and, of course, in Syria, where ISIS, since June 10th, when it broke out of Syria and swept into the city of Mosul, has taken town after town after town, and is on the brink of taking Baghdad.
And what's so bizarre, though, about that, Howard, is we support them in Syria, but not in Iraq.
Well, we're trying not to support them. We've worked very hard not to support them. We've worked very hard not to give them any arms. But the fact is that it looks as if Saddam or Bashar Assad, the head of Syria, favored them when he's been bombing rebels. He has not been bombing the rebels of ISIS. Why? Because they are extremists, and he wants the world to know that it's either him or the extremists. So he's been favoring the extremists.
Well,
but there's a
smart
problem here, because remember, there's a proxy war going on in the Middle East. You and I have been talking about it. It's a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has been supporting ISIS. They say they have not, but the fact is that the guys in charge, the royal family, doesn't have to do it officially. The money leaks out from lower levels of the royal family in massive quantities. The Chinese once upon a time tried this strategy when they ran out of money, over-militarizing, in order to stave off their enemies. They would find the enemy of their enemy, and they would train and arm the enemy of their enemy. And the same thing always happened. The enemy of their enemy would defeat their enemy. And having defeated their enemy, the enemy of their enemy would then turn on the Chinese and come marching into the Chinese capital and would take over. The Saudis don't know that lesson. Beware of the enemy of your enemy. That's how we got Al-Qaeda, by favoring the enemy of our enemy, the Soviet Union. And there's one other factor to be very aware of. In all of our manuals on strategy, we leave out the most important thing. Human beings hunger to be part of something bigger than themselves. ISIS offers humans the opportunity to be something, to be a part of something so big that it's God's own mission. We have to get down to understanding why we have something major to offer. We are a nation dedicated to a proposition, said Abraham Lincoln, that all men are created equal. And the things we do are beyond belief. They are beyond stunning. We've talked about this before, but we've doubled the human lifespan in 150 years. We have made the poorest paid worker earn what a tenement full of the poorest paid workers earned in 1850. We have raised the average IQ 35 points, and we have increased the factor of peace, as hard as this is believed this week. We have increased the factor of peace in this world by 9 times. No other civilization has ever done that. That is a higher purpose worth living and even worth dying for.
And still, Howard, it's a world in turmoil. I was with Howard, by the way, this weekend in Denver, taping a Beyond Belief television program for a future episode. He did a great job, as he always does. Thanks, Howard. During the mid-2000s, the CIA sought to undermine Osama bin Laden by creating an action figure of the al-Qaeda boss that morphed into a demon doll. The agency's hope was that the frightening transformation of the figure would turn those in the region where he was believed to be hiding against him, especially children. It's unclear how many action figures called Devil Eyes were produced. Public confidence in television news is at an all-time low, according to a survey released today by Gallup. Only 18% of the Americans surveyed expressed either a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in that news medium. It's a group that is often overlooked, bound between two much larger generations. Generation X, the persona, is less distinctive than the baby boomers or the millennials. And they found that between 2007 and 2010, that they lost 45% of their wealth. And those ages ranges from 34 to 49 years old, right in the middle innings, they say, of life. Michael Shedlock, investment advisor with us. Mish, that 45%, that's a huge drop in earnings.
It is. I did a post on this, George, just a couple of days ago on my blog. And we talked about this last month, too. The inflation figures were hot last month. Well, they were even hotter 3 days ago. They came out. Inflation was up 0.4% in a month. And I looked at real hourly wages, and I put together a chart, and real hourly wages are back to a level of 1968. Now, that's just wages. What do you think taxes and Social Security and fees of all sorts have done since 1960? We would be better off, George, with the $2.50 wages we had back then if we had prices back to the same level. Taxes are eating everyone up. Another jump in the CPI this month. People are struggling to make ends.
Yeah, yet the Federal Reserve says yesterday they're thinking of raising interest rates sometime next year.
They think they're going to do this. They think the economy's booming. Booming for who, George? Certainly the stock market is. You know, I don't understand it. At least something I do understand jumped today. Gold on the inflation news the last few days, gold was up almost $40 today. We'll see if that holds. But even if it doesn't, wages just aren't keeping up for the average guy like they are for the average CEO, right?
You got that right. Mish, thank you so much. Well, here's a switch for you. Warnings about the risk of suicide in young people prescribed antidepressant medication may have backfired. Now, this is according to researchers. A study in the British Medical Journal showed that a sudden fall in antidepressant prescriptions and a rise in suicide attempts after media reports of the connection. The team at Harvard Medical School said the unintended effect was disturbing. Experts said similar changes had been seen in other countries. Songwriter Jerry Goffin, who penned chart-topping songs with his then-wife Carole King, has died at the age of 75 here in Los Angeles. He wrote dozens of hits over two decades, including Will You Love Me Tomorrow, The Locomotion, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman. He was inducted along with Carole King into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1990. He is dead at the age of 75. A 22-pound house cat, that's pretty big, that had attacked a baby and trapped a family in a bedroom in Portland, has lashed out again, frightening new owners with his violent nature, jeopardizing his chance at finding a permanent home. The couple who had taken in Lux the cat, whose violent tendencies have drawn nationwide notoriety, have simply given up on him. He's a black and white Himalayan, made headlines and newscasts in March when he scratched the face of a seven-month-old baby's face. The father went ballistic, kicked the cat, and barricaded the family in a bedroom. They called police. They had to be saved. The police say they have never seen a cat as violent in 20 years. What will become of the cat? Well, anybody's guess. But you know what they do with animals like that. Up next, Matt Stein joins me. We will be talking about when technology fails, when disaster strikes. Next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. For the next couple hours, you're going to hear a riveting story from Matt Stein back on Coast to Coast. Matt is a design engineer, green builder, author of two best-selling books, as I mentioned, When Disaster Strikes, When Technology Fails, two separate books, graduate of Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, where he majored in mechanical engineering. He's an active mountain climber, serves as a guide and instructor for blind skiers. What an amazing feat there. Has written several articles on the subject of sustainable living and is a guest columnist for the Huffington Post. Welcome back to Coast, Matt Stein. Matt, how are you?
Well, I'm doing really terrific tonight, George. It's always a pleasure to be on Coast to Coast. Thanks so much for having me back on.
My pleasure. My guest last night, Richard Allen Miller, just raved about you all night.
He's quite a character.
And then when I told him you were on, he went crazy. So that's good. I also understand you have had, if I can ask you, a tragedy in the family.
Oh yeah, it was. I've just come through a very rough couple years. My wife died 3 days before Christmas of multiple myeloma cancer, and it's one of those cancers that doesn't show up in cancer normal blood indicators and markers. So it's commonly misdiagnosed for a while until you get to doctors get really frustrated, can't figure out what's going on, keep sending in more specialists, and finally somebody knows, you know, suspects what it is and orders a very expensive, very specialized test and confirms that that's it.
Well, our deepest condolences to you and members of your family over that loss.
Yeah, it was terrible. I mean, right now, it's been about 6 months, so I've recouped to the point where I'm willing to talk about it in more detail because you know, I couldn't really do that without breaking down crying a few months ago.
And I don't want to dwell on it, Matt, but I just wanted you to know that all of us here at Coast to Coast felt very badly about that situation, and I wish it was something we could do, but, you know, what can you?
Well, it was frustrating because, you know, everybody involved, you know, the oncologist, the alternative MDs, my son, my daughter, myself, you know, we all wanted my wife to heal and to do the best. And there was conflicting opinions about what the best treatment would be, what the best course would be. And you know, certainly I'm not about to, my wife would never let me force my opinion on her anyway. She was very strong-willed. And so, you know, we had conflicting opinions even within the family of what to do. And it's a tough situation when you're faced with a, quote, terminal disease and something is dangled out and they say, well, but we can give you several good years if you do this and, you know, that kind of stuff. And it's really difficult to pick and choose when it's you or a loved one. And certainly the choices I would have made would have been different from the choices my wife did make.
Yeah.
And, you know, eventually basically, when it was too late, she decided to give the alternates a really serious choice. But by that time, one of her doctors had already told her, sweetheart, you know, we can't heal multiple myeloma. At some point, you just stop with the invasive treatments and to make yourself comfortable and get ready to die. And so it was really only once she had actually heard that she decided that she was really ready to try some of these other things. And it was pretty late in the game to do that. And I think we may still have turned it around if she was able to get herself to do a couple of the things really 100%. It's like she bought into them in her mind, but it was kind of like buying a gym membership. And, you know, and another friend of mine who'd gone through chemo and survived a terminal cancer and you know, had done chemo and then switched to alternates and healed, she said, you know, that chemo just messes with your taste buds so bad, so that I can understand your wife not being able to stomach the things I was trying to get her to drink. It's like I'd mix it up, the green alkalizing drinks, and I'd drink mine down, and she'd drink, like, you know, three sips of hers, and the rest would go on drunk. So I can't fault the protocol when she started so late and just simply wasn't able to do it.
Okay. Matt, you have written a couple bestsellers, When Technology Fails, When Disaster Strikes. And you heard Mike Shedlock on the air with us just a few minutes before you came on, talking about the economic turmoil and where we are right now. Where, in your opinion, are we? I mean, we went through a horrible situation in 2008, and there are some people who are saying today it's not going to get any better. It's going to get worse. Where are you here?
Well, we have so many fronts that are going to challenge society as we know it in the coming decades. And I just, basically, in my mind, I wrote an article that went quite viral on the internet called The Perfect Storm, Six Trends Converging on Collapse. So basically, we have these environmental and civilization trends that they're all, like, if you draw a graph and the graph is headed steeply towards the bottom, if you don't do something radically different, it's going to keep going to the bottom, and when it hits bottom, it's basically game over. And so we have all these trends. They're headed for the bottom. So I believe that we do have another financial bubble like 2008 that's being propped up artificially. And I'm not a financial expert, but every indicator I have is that that's being propped up. I believe that we have a climate change situation on the planet where what we've done to the planet, according to over 95% of the world's climate scientists, are in agreement that yes, mankind is altering the chemistry of the atmosphere and the oceans, and it's changing them in very negative ways, and there are time lags on these. I'm very aware of system response from my MIT stuff. So basically, the stuff that we've done 20 years ago and 30 years ago are what we're really seeing today, and the stuff we're doing today we'll see in another 10 or 20 years. So we're seeing an accelerating decline that if we did everything right today, is still going to be extremely difficult. And if we don't radically change what we're doing, it's going to basically collapse our systems and our societies. Now, I don't know the time frame. I can't tell you, oh, in 2 years it's going to all fall apart. I can't give you that information. But I'm 57, and I believe unless something kills me prematurely, that I'm going to see things really, really fall apart on my planet,
right,
you know, why in my lifetime. And I don't think it's going to be real far. Now, when I wrote, people say, well, why would an MIT engineer write a book called When Technology Fails? I mean, it's like, aren't you supposed to be totally into technology and think that, you know, that technologists and scientists are the gods of our world and they're going to create all these nifty solutions that are going to make it all better? Well,
they'll try, but it could fail.
We'll try.
Yeah.
We'll try. Right. But it's like we cannot, we're not gods. We're not miracle workers. Even though you may look at an iPhone and say, well, that's scientists. We see signs of crashing, failing natural systems all over the planet. We're seeing record extinctions not seen since the asteroid hit the planet and wiped out the dinosaurs 60 million years ago or 40 million, whatever that, you know, huge number is. We're seeing changes in the last 20 years of my lifetime that are radical as far as last millions of years, many millions of years on the planet. We're seeing stuff happening in 20 years. It normally takes millions of years to happen. So we are in trouble. And how bad, and depending on our actions, I believe that right now it's like we're in a freight train. It's going 100 miles an hour, and the tracks are ending just down around the corner. And there's a big...
Over the edge we go.
Cliff right there. Now, or there's a big stone wall that we're going to run into. So the question is, if we put the brakes on really heavily, maybe we'll slow down enough so that when we hit that wall, the damage won't be too
maybe
bad.
So. Hold on for a second, Matt. We're going to hit this break, and we're going to come back in a moment and talk more with you about that cliff. Could it be the fiscal cliff? Much more to talk about here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back. And welcome back. Matt Stein with us. Matt, I guess there are things that we can control. There are obviously things we can't control. But in terms of the things we can control, it's probably pretty smart for people to start preparing right now, isn't it?
Well, yeah. There's no question that you need to be prepared for disruptions. You know, some of the question is how long and when will they happen? And, you know, one of the things I mentioned before is, you know, you say, well, why isn't engineer writing something like when technology fails? And back in 1997, at that point in time, I'd had a 20-year practice of daily prayer and meditation. Nothing fanatic, and you know, but it's a good way to start my day.
Sure is, yeah.
And roughly Thanksgiving of 1997, I made a generic request for guidance and inspiration. And on that morning, at 6 in the morning, I got a bomb dropped in my lap. It was all of a sudden I received this giant, massive, pictorial, sort of moving picture, three-dimensional storyboard outline for a huge book project dumped into my head instantly. And my first thought was like, no way. I mean, I don't know all this. I can't do this. And I'm an engineer, not a writer. And Jesus calls it the still small voice. The voice, little voice in my head said, nobody knows it all. And it assured me that I had the skills and talents that if I chose to take the assignment on, and it always felt much more like my assignment than my idea, that I'd get the inner and outer help I needed. Well, I didn't just jump right up and say, you know, God talked to me today and I'm going to write this cool book to help people in the coming times. It took me about a year to decide maybe I could actually do it, another year to do a book proposal and find a publisher, and then another year to really bite the bullet and commit, work 70 hours a week and finish off the book. And in studying, in researching for When Technology Fails, I read more books in that three-year period than I'd read in my entire life, high school, grade school, MIT, and 20 years after MIT. Add all those books together, and I read more in the three-year period of time than I'd done my entire life up to that point. So this was a huge, huge project, and I can't tell you God told me to do it. I can tell you I believe it was a higher power that inspired me. It was such a fully developed concept given to me, gifted to me on that day. I mean, a term paper in college at MIT was a major ordeal for me, and this is like 40 term papers in one, and yet it was given to me fully developed, instantaneously dumped into my head. Now, they didn't tell me how things are going to fall apart or when things are going to fall apart, but they did indicate that in the not very distant future, that many, many millions of people would be needing the information in this book. So I would say, from a rational, scientific, engineer point of view, there are so many challenges to our world and our complex society right now that from the strictly rational point of view, it only makes sense to be prepared for disruptions of increasing length. But I will also say, from a spiritual point of view, given the way it came to me, I'm certain, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that it's coming. I just can't tell you when. Now, one of the things that happened today that's quite disturbing, there's some breaking news that a friend of mine I happened to call him up for the first time in like a year. In fact, he didn't even know that my wife had passed.
Oh, geez.
And we were chatting about solar storms, and it turns out that the government passed a regulation today, reliability standard for geomagnetic disturbance operations. Now, it sounds on the surface like this is a really good thing they passed. It's like, oh, they're going to protect us. So if there's a major solar storm, everything's going to be okay. But what it is a smokescreen. It was written by the industry to protect the power electrical generation industry from liability in the event that a solar storm happens and it fries the grid.
Wow.
And millions of people die.
That's a huge story.
Right. So what they're doing is they've got a smokescreen. They're basically saying, it's covered. We've written we've written this bill, and it's going to outline a procedure for how they're going to protect us in the event of solar storm. But it's not going to force them to make any changes, to put any of the hardware in place that for a couple of billion dollars, the price of a single stealth bomber, one of those, just one stealth bomber, they could prevent the end of the world as we know it. And what they're doing is they're writing a piece of legislation so that liability-wise, they're protected and say, well, I did what the government told me to do, so it's okay. Well, oh, millions of people are starving, and there's multiple Fukushima-like meltdowns of power plants because they've run out of backup fuel to keep the generators going, and the grid's down, and power plants can't operate with a grid-down situation, which is why they burned up in Fukushima. And we're going to have these all over the country in the event of a major solar storm, and it'll be like, oh, well, don't worry. They're covered by this piece of paper saying they're not liable for this. Well, that's where we are right now, is we've got a smokescreen to pretend that our government is protecting us in the event of these solar storms. Now, you could say,
or an EMP attack.
Or an EMP. Well, an EMP will be much more electrical damage in a much more concentrated area. But the plus about an EMP is that the rest of the world is there to come in. The cavalry can come in from outside of the area to help put things together. I mean, I'm not saying an EMP is not horrible. It is. I mean, it'll be horrible, and it could totally take down the government and disrupt the nation for a long time and cause multiple Fukushima-like events within the EMP zone. But a major solar storm, there's going to be no cavalry to come in from anywhere.
I agree.
Because it's going to be all over the planet.
Nobody to blame.
And these things, right, you can't blame and say, oh, Ram did it. What you can do is blame and say, wow, we did the EMP Commission studied this back in 2008 and recommended to Congress that for very affordable amount of money, we could fix this problem. And NERC, North American Electric Reliability Corporation, then they co-funded this HILF report, this high impact, low frequency, where they studied the most serious potential threats that could really destroy our world, the black swan events. And they decided that out of everything that might happen, the two main threats that could really, really stick it to our world was EMPs and solar storms.
That's right.
So what does NERC do? Well, NERC fires the guys that did the HILF report, puts new guys in, comes out with a new study and says, everything's okay. Don't worry. We got it covered. And then what do? Now they have this bogus thing put through Congress that they wrote. NERC wrote this, and it says, here's the procedure to deal with solar storms. Everything's okay. But what they're ignoring is what the scientists said, what the EMP Commission said, what the data from the Meditech study said, which said that in the event of a major solar storm, like the 1921 one, which was 50% weaker than the 1859 Carrington event, so that's two huge solar storms, game-changing events, happened in the last 150 years. It was 90 years since the last one and only 60 years before that. Average of every 75 to 100 years, these hit the planet. It's been 90 years.
Yeah.
Do the math. We're either overdue or due right now.
Well, and we've been lucky because we've had some big X flares, Matt, and they just weren't facing us directly.
Right. And all it takes is one of those to hit the planet. And suddenly, you're going to have the most amazing lights you've ever seen at night. The sky will be lit up blood red, orange, and green, and yellow, just like it was in 1921 and 1859. And it'll go on for a couple of nights, maybe even a week. It was a week in 1859. It was 2 days in 1921. And those lights went from the North Pole all the way to Haiti and Hawaii, and from the South Pole all the way to American Samoa. So the entire planet was lit up at night except for a narrow sliver around the equator. So what that would mean is that the grid over most of the world, except for the deep tropical zones, will just collapse.
Why doesn't a presidential candidate, Matt, simply say,
fix it?
Among everything I'm doing in my campaign pledge, this is one thing we're going to do, folks. We're going to fix and insulate our grid against a solar flare or an EMP attack because it is in the best interests of the American people. It's national defense policy. That's one of the things I'm going to do immediately when I'm elected. Why don't they say that?
I would vote for somebody who'd say that. That would be enough to make me vote for somebody.
Me too.
People, They just don't understand it. What frustrates me is you have someone like you have Newt Gingrich, who was a huge, you know, he was a big player, and he talked a lot about EMP and solar storm. And yet, I read what Newt wrote, and it was clear he had not read the EMP report. He had not read the science. Here he is talking like he's an expert on it, and he's probably more up on it than almost everybody else in Congress. And yet he's making statements about EMP that are just plain false, that are wrong. And it's clear that the guy who's talking like he's the expert in Congress on it didn't actually read the report. And so if the, quote, expert in Congress didn't read the report, what did the rest of the guys do? And so when I wrote my article, 400 Chernobyls, a couple years back, I planned on spending a week in the article. I was compulsed. I printed out a stack of papers 14 inches tall, and I spent 6 weeks with no work, no pay, to do an article totally for free, printed on the internet, and on it got published on Huffington Post and Alternet and you know, several different places. It went totally viral, and I just couldn't stop until I felt I had all the information and had really found it, because I knew we were in trouble, but I was hoping it was better than I was concerned about. It turned out it was worse. It's actually more like 4,000 Chernobyls. Basically what happens is, see when Fukushima went down, people think, well, the earthquake caused the reactors to melt down. Well, the official story is the reactors, when the earthquake hit, the grid went down instantly, and a reactor is designed to go into emergency shutdown as soon as the grid collapses, because it can't feed energy to itself to keep the pumps going. That'd be like trying to take a sip out of a fire hose. It would blow your face off. So there's so much energy being produced in a reactor that when the grid shuts down, they immediately have to go into emergency shutdown mode and disconnect from the grid, because they got to take all that energy and put it somewhere. So when they do that, then there's no power from the grid, so the backup generators kick in and the pumps kick in, you know, with power from the backup generators. Well, so Fukushima happens. There's 4 out of 6 of the nuclear reactors are in operation. 2 are down for refueling. So there's only 4 out of 6 that are operating. Thank God there wasn't 6 out of 6. And they go down. Then 20 minutes later, the tsunami comes along. Well, 5 of those 6 reactors had their backup generators on the ocean side. Now, here they have cave paintings around Fukushima with cave paintings of tsunamis. So, you know, it's known to be an area with tsunamis. Well, engineers are smart guys, but they don't think of everything. You know, I'm one of them, and I wish I thought of everything, but I just can't. So the tsunami wipes out 5 of the 6 backup generators. So the only one that has an operating generator is number 6, and that's the only one that didn't melt down at all. So then two of the reactors in 15 minutes are full meltdown mode. You know, the 3rd of the 4 reactors that are operating goes into partial meltdown, and then they're able to shunt power from number 6 back to number 5, and they prevent it from going into full meltdown, but it was still partial meltdown. So, okay, so fast forward now. Imagine we have a solar storm or an EMP comes along, and it wipes out the grid. Well, these reactors have a week's worth of backup fuel stored to keep those power generators going.
If that.
Well, they're mandated to have a week. But many reactor guys told me, well, we have a month. Okay, well, imagine an EMP or solar storm hits. Imagine a solar storm, worst case. Solar storm is really bad. The Meditech Corporation study indicated that with a solar storm the size of 1921, which they predict from ice core samplings happens every 75 to 100 years, one of those things hits, the computer modeling indicates that 350, 360, 370 of these massive transformers that keep our grid functioning are going to burn down.
And we only have a couple backups. That's it.
We have 1 or 2 backups. The 350 will go down. When one went down in the 1989 geomagnetic storm, which was 10% as strong as 1921, which is 50% weaker than the 1859, when one went down in near Three Mile Island, one went down in Quebec, and one went down in the U.K. Well, they managed to keep the U.K. grid going. They managed to keep the U.S. grid going, but all of Quebec lost power.
They did.
6 million
That's right.
people lost power. That's from losing one.
How long were they out, Matt? Do you remember?
Well,
a couple
of
days?
They were out for about for 9 hours to 2 days, depending on where you were. Now, when 2006, a geomagnetic storm hit South Africa, and it eventually caused 14 of their transformers to fail. They didn't all fail at once. This was a fairly weak geomagnetic storm, but for some reason it just hit South Africa really hard. Now, 14 of them went down. It took them a year to replace those 14 because these things are tens of millions of dollars each. They're hundreds of tons each. They're 20 feet tall. You have to shut down a freeway to deliver them. They're custom made and custom designed per installation. The current capacity, manufacturing capacity in the year is about 100 of these a year. So you're talking about in the world. If you're talking a huge geomagnetic storm, you're going to lose at least 2,000 of these in the world. That's like 20 years of manufacturing capacity if the world's working well.
And Matt,
but most of the countries that make this stuff will be down.
And if this happens, let's say, in a winter that we had this year, you know, where the Midwest and the East were frozen for about a month, how many people are going to die?
Well, they're talking in a very conservative projection. They're estimating that it would leave 130 million Americans without power to 1 to 2 years. Now, when I spoke with John Kappenman, who authored the Meditech Corporation study that was sponsored by the DOE and the Oak Ridge National Labs, I mean, these are really bright guys. He said, when I said, really, John, is that realistic or is that really, really optimistic? And he said, no, it's optimistic. I mean, think about it.
Wow.
We had killer trees in the East Coast, took out power to 50 million people. First, they thought that it was some terrorist act up at the Niagara Falls, you know,
power generation.
But it turned out it was just hot, you know, power lines sagged into trees. The grid was old and aging and over, you know, it was like running near capacity, and it caused a chain reaction event. 50 million people lost power, some of it for several days. On the West Coast, you had killer trees like in 1995. On a really hot day when the air conditioning was going everything, it took out power to like 7 states and 2 provinces in Canada from just trees. So if you have a geomagnetic storm, this is not trees. This is a geomagnetic storm causing pulses in there. And what they do is they induce these huge current spikes, but they're totally out of synchronous with the 110 AC, you know, that's cycling at 60 times a second. And when they do that, they cause eddy currents in these massive transformers, and they lose efficiency. Now, when you have megawatts of power going through a transformer, and all of a sudden it loses 20% efficiency, then you got megawatts of heat going into the transformer as efficiency losses, and it burns the thing up. And if it doesn't burn it up immediately, it causes so much damage that eventually it fails. So in South Africa, the 14 that failed, they didn't all fail immediately, but they failed within, you know, months of the solar storm. And the only way South Africa could cope before they got those replacements in, you know, a year later, was they had to do rolling blackouts and throughout the entire country for a year. So imagine trying to work when for 6 or 7 hours, 3 days or 4 days of the week, you don't have no power and you don't know when, and you can't buy a backup generator because every single one was scarfed up in the first, you know, 2 hours after the blackout hit. And for a whole year, you're dealing with rolling blackouts. You got 6 hours, you got no air conditioning, you got no lights, you got no heat, you got no elevators, you got no refrigeration going on. I mean, your food's rotting, your restaurant's shut down. Try doing business that way for a year. Now, that's losing 14.
Well, as De Niro said,
370 at one shot
that's
in the United States and 2,000 in the world.
You've got nothing.
Good luck.
You have nothing.
You have nothing. That's right. Nothing in our world will work. No internet. No nuclear power. So
smartphones,
now,
they don't work, right?
Well, for what you have when the power goes down, in 3 hours you start losing your relay stations for your smartphones. In 3 days, your central telephone switching stations lose backup power.
Well, what about my show? I'm on generators, but how long are we going to last on that?
Right. You talk within 3 days, most hospitals and police stations will be out of power. You're talking a week to a month, depending on how much fuel they stored, and nuclear power plants will run out of fuel and start melting down.
And what about the crime, Matt? What about the crime?
You're talking refinery shutdown. They're not able to make fuel. You're talking crime. You're talking, well, the government says, oh, we're going to magically, like the world is falling apart. When they ran this scenario, they had about a year or two ago, they did a big tabletop scenario where they invited the best first responders and police and disaster planners, and then they gave them the scenario, and they basically all said, wow, in this situation, we're going to stay home and protect our family.
That's right.
We're going to leave our posts and protect our family.
Matt, we're going to come back, talk more, take calls on Coast to Coast AM.